Brigitte Sharma and Thomas Devaney.
We could ask each other questions.
Yeah, we could. I mean, we could.
How do you know each other?
Well, we were neighbors.
In Philadelphia?
No, in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, we used to make a lot of dinners together and drink together and read a lot of poems together.
Tom was witnessed my whole courting with my husband, and I'm grateful that was
I was there when
cool.
They met, and then I said, is it okay? She's like, yeah, you can leave. I'm like, okay. Like, they're having fun.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can tell you that I just finished co-organizing this race and creative writing conference, and one thing I was trying to do with Undergloom was to try to figure out the negotiation between complaint or grievance, and then also craft and a voice. So. And to figure out, you know, I really noticed somewhere like Montana teaching the Black Arts Movement or thinking about styles that come from community work and ideas of solidarity rather than craft were getting complicated. I was trying to develop poems that could do several things at once and have like an abject center, like the voice. So, you know, I'm coming out of Richard Hugo world where the, you know, Triggering Town, which is a wonderful book, but it kind of gives you a prescription on how to write a poem and what your voice should be like and what everything should be like. And Montana has a rich tradition of incredible writers, but I wanted to be oppositional about what it meant to have a voice or an authorial voice. But so being there for a long time, I think I complained about diversity and how writers of color are taught. And so when Dorothy Wong came out with Thinking Its Presence, you know, Asian American Poetry and Subjectivity, where she does a close reading of Marilyn Chin and John Yao and Mamie Bershenberger and Pamela Liu, she makes a point of saying that writers of color have to be stopped. They have to stop teaching it like they're for content and more for innovation, so that they're not always minorities with grievances and that the poem is just a grievance, but that there are the formal and innovations that are both experimental and narrative. So Joanna Klink and I put together a conference basically just getting scholars and writers and artists together to read, present, perform, and teach, and do pedagogical interrogations of really innovative work by writers of color, and to create a safe space of solidarity so people could speak from feelings of, you know, of being marginalized in the institution. I'm done.
Did you grow up reading writers of color?
I did, but I remember being taught them. And it was always a themed, you know, it's like, well, we're doing that this month, or we're supposed to learn, you know, some kind of anthropological study rather than admiring the craft of it.
You talked about complaint and
grievance.
Grievance.
Yes.
So, what do you think now is the difference?
I mean, I think that I have been exploring them both. And I'd have to think about what the difference is. Grievances feel formal, and I do explore legal. I found out, I was writing about my dad who had experienced discrimination, and I realized that the poem will never be a legal document. So you can put a lot of grievances in there, and you can speak the truth, and nobody will. I mean, I love reading Howell and making the case for the fact that you really it's hard to be held to that as a legal document, a poem. So I'd have to think about whether grievances are in the poem in strategic ways to think about.
Do you think Howell's grievance?
No, but I think that it gets to explore. I think it was, well, I don't think he thought it was a grievance, but I think he was treated like a minority with grievances, and the poem itself functions that way.
Will any of the work from the conference be published?
We're hoping, so what we're going to do is try to do a retreat and put a membership and a board together. And once we do that, then we're going to figure out where we go next, if UM wants to keep us. But we want to be a board first, so that when we move to another institution, the board still manages the conference, and then we could publish. And NEH said I could write a grant for, they can't support conferences, but they can support publications. And I'm sure, Steve, you've been doing a lot with NEH for the Poetry Center.
NEA more for us.
Oh, the NEA, but for the archival, I thought NEH.
I've looked at NEH in terms of the archive.
The archive, that's what I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or publications. But I'm just thinking about, Tom, you've been so community-oriented in your poems, and I feel like I was just going to ask you about how it moves from how art and community function as subjects. Like, if they feel different from one another, are they the same move?
Well, I mean, the poem "The Blue Stoop" is a world that I have access to, and I want it to access that, and it's a robust world. I think that the person speaking in that poem has a chip on his shoulder or her shoulder, and kind of pride about that place, and so there's nothing to apologize for in that poem, in that world. And every poem is different. Every poem has a different world. But the poem that I engaged my sister, I wanted to just treat her as a person, and a person that I have fights with, and who I love, and who knows me, and I know her, and that relationship, and just be as brutally honest as I could about it. So that's a private world, and the Blue Stoop's maybe a public world. You know, there's class issues that come up in some of the work, and then there's just stuff that jumps off the page, like the other poem with the runaway go-kart. I have no idea where that comes from.
Had you seen the trailer piece?
Yeah, I did. I saw that painting.
You've seen that piece, yeah.
And I only saw it for 10 minutes, but then I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
It kind of haunted my imagination, and I thought it was much bigger than it was. It's kind of a little painting.
Uh-huh.
He's a great African-American artist from, I guess, Alabama, that he's kind of blowing up. They call that untrained artist, but... He's on the cover of the new Norton Anthology of African American Literature I just saw. The newest one.
He's not around any longer, is he?
In your poem about Annie
Trailer is not
well. Was the conversation or was the voice that you used for her based on historical conversation, or did you create this voice for her?
No, I created the voice. Okay. I did had a kind of thumbnail sketch of her biography, mm-hmm. of Calamity Jane.
Yeah.
And the voice that I had
in
my head was like something my grandmother said very specifically, and then Janine Olson's voice, and then my own voice. So it's a combination of things. But then once I had the voice, then I could ask it questions and things like that.
Yeah, sorry about that, Calamity Jane, and that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. it's a very complicated thing that I did there, and you know, I don't know. I just wrote it, and because it was specifically for this person, whenever I got stuck, I thought of her.
Okay.
I thought, what would Janine say, or what would Janine do?
How did you get to know, or what was your relationship with Ernesto Neto?
I worked in a gallery, just guarding his artwork for 2 weeks as a side job. And there was a kind of a installation. It was a sculpture. You had to go into the wall. And I just sat on a chair, and I told everyone to take off their shoes and their bags, and then they could go in there. And in the second week, I was so bored, I just had a notebook, and I started writing him letters, like 2:30, 2:45, I write another one. And then I sent them to him, and then he wrote back, and then we did a book. And then I got, he would call me from Miami. He said, hey, can you come and meet me for a drink? I'm like, I live in Philadelphia. He's crazy. He's like the Brazilian John Belushi. I mean, he's just, I love Ernesto. He's a great man.
I have a question for Thomas. I have actually a couple of questions. But the first one would be the poem about your sister. How did she react when that was published in
Syracuse? She doesn't speak. So she has severe brain damage. So she's high functioning. So you know, if we're talking, you're like, hey Colleen, could you get the milk out of the refrigerator or a spoon or something, or she would get it. And so she understands a lot, but if I read that to her, she would just sit there and laugh at me, probably. Like, she wouldn't understand. But
does she know that it exists?
No. It's not, she doesn't read. One of her friends, who's been friends with her for her whole life, George, he came up to me and says, Tom, I really think your sister's mad at me. I said, why, George? He said, she never talks to me. I said, George said, she's so non-communicative. And I said, George, she doesn't speak to anyone, not just you. So don't take it hard, buddy. She loves you.
So my second question is, you said you teach at Haverford?
Yes.
So I actually went to Bryn Mawr for a semester, and I'm just curious about poems about place, because when I was at Bryn Mawr, I felt maybe the least creative I've ever felt in my life. And I was also at Haverford all the time, and the two places are so similar. I don't know. How do you feel about that environment and, like, that school?
Well, I think it's very beautiful. It's like on an arboretum. I think it's, I mean, I love walking through it. I wasn't a student there, but you know, you're having a different reaction to it. I don't get inspired when I walk through. I just say, gosh, I'm a super lucky person to get to walk through this super beautiful campus and see so many bright and earnest students here. I don't know. I mean, wherever you get inspiration from, that's like the great place, right? I mean, where's the spark of creation, you know? One of the things I love about Brigida's work is just that the tone of it is just so, I don't know how you do it, how you continually just push the edge and have this very steady tone that comes across. That's so powerful.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about place, and you're suggesting that we are inspired to write by place, but I'm interested in when we're not inspired, when we grapple with place or we answer questions through that. I wonder what the poems written there, or you know, what it would be like to write about not being able to write in a place. Hmm. That's really interesting. I want to know why.
About
Raymar? Yeah, I mean, just it's a very provocative, not provocative, but not being inspired by a place is also really, I just think that's interesting stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
For me, it was just, it felt stifling.
Stifling is really interesting for art, I think.
You said something when you were talking about the Calamity Jane book, Tom, that you said this solo opera. And what's your sense there?
My sense of poems have music inside of them. They don't need other music. They don't need backup singers. They don't need anything. Poems are just, they are their own music. And so when you write when that book, it's a little backed off. It's a little bit more like speaking or more like, and so some of the poems could have music written for them. I know I was thinking of the future collaboration. And some of them are songs, like Whiskey, Whiskey, Martha, Whiskey, 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 Oh, which is like, you know, a song that I took from somewhere else, a folk song.
Yeah, can I say, I find that interesting that you said that. I've written some different poems that were taken with permission and turned into song, because I find that I'm not finding the music in it to make it lyrical and create the song from a poem. But for you, then you're saying that most of your poems then have a music, and that's what you hear when you're putting it on the page then, is its own music?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sure I got what you were saying. Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't think it needs other music. It is, you know, poems aren't music, but they have the song somehow. There's something in it.
Because I see them as paintings. So when I put them on the page, for me, they're paintings. And I think that's, and I have a difficult time finding the music, the lyrical part of it, and creating a song, right? Because for me, it's a painting. It's more abstract or tangible, or and music isn't. I play the drums as well, and music isn't tangible, right?
It's great. It just, however we all work it out, like, it's so interesting how we think about music and words and how they can come together and how they don't come together.
Right. Question, but thank you. It's a dialogue.
I mean, back to the landscape question too. I mean, I think it's a kind of a generative space to be, like, in resistance to a space that you don't like, and that's your place of creation, which is, I don't feel comfortable here, and that is a powerful place of, like, I have to figure out what to do about it. What's under that for me?
Well, like you said with the Neto, you were sitting there, being bored to death by your circumstance, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I was getting paid like $7 an hour, and just I was working a job, and then I wrote these letters to this guy, and he wrote me back. I didn't know what I was doing with my life.
Well, you were making art.
I was writing a book, and someone was paying me.
It was a rare.
And now there's 300 copies of that book, and it doesn't exist. That's great. I love that book.
Well, we've sort of run out of time, so let's thank both of them.